Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My guest today is an academic and historian who has firmly put her stamp on everything from graphic design and feminism to the creation of fanzines. She's a Texan who observed rioting in her youth and, amid the politically charged atmosphere of 1980s America, headed to the UK to live in London. In pursuing a career as an academic, Teal Triggs has remained ever inquisitive over the way in which the public consumes information. She's trained the microscope on the Pussy Galore typeface in Fuse 12 propaganda and looked at the role of women in craft and design. She's authored to an eponymous book on fanzines and, as we meet in the shadow of the Royal Albert Hall at the Royal College of Art, where she's an associate dean, I begin by asking her about the subject dear to my heart.
First of all, thanks very much for asking me to be involved in this interview. Any excuse to talk about zines. I think it's really important for me that what the zines represent are individuals or the collectives that have created the zines. Mm. And it's the notion of the hand. So the handmade, the do-it-yourself, it's individuals who want to say something to somebody else about their passions. And that takes a lot of respect, I think, from a reader's perspective. Mm. I find zines in general a really accessible medium. And if I don't know something, and if I can read a zine and I get one or two tidbits of information out of it or an opinion, or where a gig's going to be, or you know where you can shop for the latest Pez dispensers, whatever it happens to be, I think there is a value in terms of this as a medium of communication. Mm. And they're just lovely things to hold, and they say something about the human-centeredness that I think in this day and age, you know, we tend to forget about because of digital technologies, and everything is our handheld mobile phone, and it's PDF downloads, and it's, you know, everything that has to do with the immaterial, the intangible.
Yes.
But these things are real. You can hold them. You can feel a sense of passion and commitment and energy from the person that's made them. So they're special objects.
Yeah, absolutely. And intrinsically, do you think that's what makes a good zine, the amount of sort of passion that someone's put into it? Or is it more about being very specific on a certain subject?
I think it's a combination. I think the zines that work for me, and all of them do on one level or another, as you're suggesting in your question, but I think what it does for me is it actually says this is an individual or, as I said, a collaborative piece of work. And there's a voice or voices that come along with that. And I think it's the fact that there's somebody who has a space to actually say something and take the time to say something means that we should perhaps read it, listen to it, engage with it in some kind of way. And I think it's that connection between the maker, the producer, the reader, the listener, again, depending on what kind of form the zines are taking.
Yes.
So I think there's something intrinsic in that kind of act of exchange.
Absolutely.
As well.
So one of your other big passions, of course, is music. I'm delighted. I can't wait to hear what your choices are today. What's the first song that you've got for us?
Well, what I decided to do in looking at these, I think, 8 songs that you asked me to consider for today is to kind of think back about what's still in my collection. So where's the timelessness to some of the music that we're going to talk about? The first song I want to talk about has to come from the Monkees. And this says a little bit about kind of my upbringing and my age, unfortunately. that growing up in the U.S., and in Texas in particular, at a time when pop culture and pop music was kind of coming to the fore, and a band like the Monkees coming out in 1967 with specifically Pleasant Valley Sunday, which is my all-time favorite, I think. I knew all the words. I knew, you know, Davy Jones, Mike Nesmith, Mickey Dolenz, and Peter Dwork. You know, they were all there as characters. So I watched the TV show, I did the full fan thing, got the autographs, and listened to their music.
So you were sat right there in front of the TV?
And just watched them, yeah. So 1960s, think of the American living room, just sitting on a Saturday afternoon watching, you know, the band play and the kind of scenarios.
Fantastic, that was the Monkees. As I tell you, you mentioned growing up in Texas. Can you describe what your upbringing was like? And, you know, for us here in the UK, growing up in Texas seems quite an alien situation. What was it like?
I think the first question I used to get when I first moved over here to London was, did you have a horse? And did you take the horse to school? Did you ride it to school?
Yes.
And I said, no, I didn't have a horse, but I had friends that had horses.
Right.
The second question is, do you have an oil well? I'm thinking, no, but I know people that do have an oil well.
Right.
Texas has that kind of, you know, myth about it. You know, it's the cowboys, it's the Wild West.
Yes.
And that does permeate. I mean, there is a very strong cowboy culture there. And, of course, impacts the music scene as well. But growing up there, I was born in the 1950s at a time when, you know, the American dream was beginning to emerge as we moved into the 60s. And, you know, JFK and, you know, this whole kind of notion that we as Americans had someplace to go. And we wanted to get there in a hurry.
Yes.
And it was about family values. I definitely remember leaving the front door open. Nobody was worried about security. It was very much kind of a community feel. Everybody looked after everybody else. And I was fortunate. I grew up in Austin, Texas, which... still today has an amazing reputation as a music capital.
Not least.
So the kind of first introductions to not only, you know, going to school and kind of doing the thing that everybody was doing at that time, but having this opportunity, just that the music kind of permeated through. My dad was also teaching at the University of Texas at Austin in the art department. He was a graphic designer, ran his own design studio.
Yes.
And he started teaching there in 1968, right when the riots on campus were taking place.
Absolutely.
And the student protest.
Yes.
And I distinctly remember going to campus and just kind of watching the scene unfold in front of me. So you felt a part of something actually quite exciting.
Absolutely.
And you began to have a bigger worldview, you know, the Vietnam War and the veterans and... you know, different presidents and being JFK being shot and, you know, all that coming through in terms of being a Texan. But that flip side of it, in terms of it being a really fun place to grow up. There, at that time, our house was what would be considered now, you know, the kind of suburbs at the edge of the city. Going back, my brother still lives in the same house. It's right in the middle of the city. So it says something about, you know, growth in these smaller cities at that time. But you did feel like you were at the center of something. And culturally, you know, Dad had Mad Magazine sitting on the table. He picked up the Texas Rag. Which was a university publication. So all the underground publications would be in the house. He knew a lot of the originators, having, you know, taught a lot of them in terms of illustrators and designers.
Yes.
So being in the middle of that was just an amazing experience as a kid.
And can you remember what your feelings were? You mentioned obviously the American dream ideal there and Vietnam. And can you remember what your opinions were at the time? And do you think that your perspective on the world now is that much different?
Very early on, you know, things like the Ku Klux Klan were happening in Texas. Well, it still is, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. And being exposed to kind of racial issues. Mm. I grew up in a very multicultural neighborhood. Mm. It wasn't an issue until somebody made it an issue, as far as we were concerned.
And
there were all sorts of, you know, ways of problematizing what was going on at that point.
Mm.
But I think, those formative years are absolutely key and gave me a perspective that I wouldn't change.
Mm.
You know, I think I'm a lot... I like to think of myself quite open-minded.
Yes.
I'm a good listener.
Yes.
And there's room for everybody. And I think those early years were quite important.
So speaking of listening, what should we listen to now?
Well, we kind of move into the mid-1970s, in fact, 1975. And I had just graduated from Crockett High School in Austin and was going to university. And we lived in an apartment complex off of Enfield Road, and it was about 10 units there, so maybe about 15 people.
Mm.
And one summer's evening, somebody had brought back from the coast a huge basket of shrimp and lots of wine. And so we had a little shrimp festival. And one of my neighbors put on the record player, Patti Smith, the Horses album, and Gloria just kind of penetrated the evening, the hot, muggy summertime evening of Austin, Texas. And we could sit there and eat our shrimp and drink our beer, our glasses of wine, listening to this amazing music, which we hadn't heard before.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Patti Smith.
Fantastic. We'll be shouting each letter as it comes, won't we?
Great stuff.
Teal Triggs. Teal, can you tell me, when did you first discover a fanzine? Did you have any idea of what one was when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think as I mentioned earlier, the house was kind of full of underground publications, and it's slightly different than a fanzine, but it's still, you know, alternative press. Mm. So I was aware that there was something else going on. And I think I had seen fanzines for some of the punk gigs in Texas floating around, but I didn't really engage with them at that point.
Mm.
And it wasn't really until I came to London. And a friend of mine had located in a trash bin somewhere in London a fanzine. And he said, I think Teal will like this.
Yes.
And he brought it to me. And it was the first issue of Sniffing Glue. So, great introduction to looking at this punk scene and thinking, my God, there's something, you know, fabulous going on here. And at that point, I just got very interested and started collecting.
Mm. But of course, Sniffing Glue, widely seen as the...
kind of the granddaddy.
Granddaddy.
Although I don't want to sure Mark Perry would want to see himself like that.
I'm sure he'll take it. But so your fascination was with both the... both what was written, but also the design that you've got a keen
absolutely.
Eye for,
I had trained as a graphic designer and photographer for my undergraduate degree at the University of Texas, and so I was always quite interested in seeing how people put books and magazines and so forth together, different kinds of publications.
Mm.
So I look at these things not only for their content, but how the content shaped by its form, and what the visual language, or the graphic language in particular, happens to be. And I think punk epitomizes how the producers of these zines were able to take The kind of intensity of the music and the intensity of the environment in which the you know, political, social, and cultural activities were going on in the late 70s, and put it together visually to really represent this kind of angst that was going on amongst the youth.
Yes.
And so I think they're beautiful objects as a result of that, but not precious, and I think that's really key.
Yes, absolutely. And when I think about making my fanzine Shadow Play, you know, I'm not... I think you're right. It's not about being precious about things. It's about letting the imperfection show through, because that in a way is what separates it from mainstream media and as well as some of the content and that kind of thing. So and I think the next band you're going to talk about are also you know, very influential in that scene.
And it kind of in a way has a tangential link back to Texas, because the next band I want to talk about is The Clash. Should I Stay or Should I Go, from the 1982. And the tangential link has to do with the fact that Joe Strummer and Joe Ely, and Joe Ely being another favorite of the Austin and Texas music scene, obviously knew each other and participated together, I think, on an album at some point.
Yes.
I think Joe was singing Spanish or what have you. So I think that's, again, quite a nice link. And I mean, you can't beat The Clash, and you can't beat, you know, the kind of wonderful tune that Should I Stay, Should I Go actually gets, you know, the community participating.
Absolutely.
Everybody singing along.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Well, let's get singing along then. This is Should I Stay or Should I Go by The Clash.
Darling, you got to let me know, should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you got to let me know, should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day is fine and next is black. So if you want me off your back, well come on and let me know, should I stay or should I go?
That was The Clash. So Till, can you tell me about your perception of how graphic design has changed in the time that you've been studying and writing about it, and has presumably the change in technology has clearly had a big factor within it, but do you think there is generally a change in the way that people approach the discipline?
Gosh, that's a really big question. I feel the lecture coming on.
Yeah, quite.
I think there has been a change in graphic design, and the change I feel is in that there's a greater awareness now from the general public about the value of graphic design. And I think early on, designers did what they did. They were engaging with their clients, you know, creating messages, being persuasive, being informative.
Yeah.
And I think now that, you know, technology, that desktop publishing prompted, you know, a plethora of little cottage industries, often untrained. So, you know, if someone wanted a leaflet for the local library group, they had that opportunity to design something on the early Macs or what have you.
Yes.
So I think there's awareness. Now, whether or not that's a good or a bad awareness, the jury's still out on that. But I think what it's done for us professionally is actually given us an opportunity to look at different ways that graphic design might be used and might be applied. So it's a way of thinking. It's a lens through which different kinds of problems and contexts can be understood and problematized, and then solutions found for it.
Yes.
So, and I think I don't know if Neville will let me say this, but I think one of my greatest memories is seeing Neville Brody on the front page of Blueprint magazine and realizing that there, in the 90s, was this kind of celebrity, the cult of celebrity emerging within graphic design. Mm. And I think now there's still a cult of celebrity, but I think there's a great awareness that these celebrities did have something to contribute, that they were really, you know, at the forefront of looking at different ways of communicating.
Yes.
I think the other thing, of course, is street signs. And people like Jacques Kinnear and Margaret Calvert doing the highway signage and typography for that. It's still out there. People are driving by it and using it as a wayfinding system.
Absolutely.
So I think things like that you know, are applied and have kind of a usefulness to them, I think, is, you know, quite exciting. Yeah.
What do you have on the wall at home?
Gosh. Lots of posters from the Armadillo World Headquarters, circa 1970.
Right.
I've got a real range of things. I've got a lot of student work up on the walls. I have a lot of my dad's paintings from the 40s. He started off as a painter before he became a designer. So, again, it's very eclectic.
Yeah.
But I don't have any posters up on the wall at the moment. So
what's the next piece of music you got for us?
The next piece I have, coming back to the kind of art school tradition, has to be Kraftwerk. And I think Computer Love, 1981, just right when the technology was beginning to hit. And as you rightly said, you know, its impact on graphic design, but even how Kraftwerk packaged itself as a brand with an amazing identity, which we know still continues today.
Absolutely. Let's hear those German wizards. So, Teal, we're sat here in the shadow of the Royal Albert Hall in the Royal College of Art. What made you pursue a career in academia, as it were, and know that you wanted to study those interests in essentially finite detail? Mm-hmm. And how do you think perceptions have changed over time about how academia is viewed, particularly in the UK?
I got into education, not only having been a student myself and done a long career moving through, you know, primary school all the way to doing a PhD.
Yeah.
But my dad was an educator himself and a designer, as I said, at the University of Texas. So I think having him as a role model and watching him engage with students and engage with a community of professionals was just fascinating in terms of how he did that. And I think one of the reasons he had gone into teaching and one of the reasons that I went into teaching is I wanted to make a difference, and I knew he wanted to make a difference. So I think being able to do that within education, it keeps you on your toes.
Yes.
You know, you can't be complacent as an educator. Students are the drivers. They know exactly what's going on. But if I can help somebody just by asking a question, get them to think about their place in the world and what they want to contribute to it, then I think there's some value into that. So that's kind of why I went to education in the first place. And I was lucky that when I came over here to do my second MA in design history at Middlesex, that one of my colleagues actually ran a program, which is down at Epsom, which is now the University of Creative Arts.
Yes.
And she invited me to do some teaching. So I had an entry level into British education. And I loved the fact at that point you didn't have any real assessments in terms of, you know, grades like we got in the States, A, B, C, D. You were assessed, but the mark was less important to the students at that point. It was more about what they actually learned.
And how easy do you find it to distill actually describing
art and art criticism, and how do you make sure that you don't get drawn into that kind of seemingly stuffy world that is presented in the mainstream media of what art criticism is, or what the academic art world perceives and what people genuinely enjoy on a day-to-day basis and that kind of thing. What's your
Yeah, I think
that?
In terms of the kind of critical aspect of it, I mean, that's always going to be there. And in some ways, if the criticism is going on around you, it means you're doing it right.
Yeah.
But I think one of the other ways that I'd like to think I'm going to stir it up a little bit, or at least give indicators of the value of an art school experience. I've just finished a children's book looking at the art school. It's going to be published by Wide-Eyed Editions later this summer. And it's how do five professors in five studios through 40 different activities in art and design help students, these kids, 10 plus, better understand the world that they live in, and what can they do to make it better.
Right.
So how do you learn about data visualization and be able to turn on and off the electricity in the art school in order to save money, but also save the planet?
Yes.
So, problematizing some of these aspects, but the value of design in relationship to, kids' learning experience. And I would love for Cameron and the rest of government to be introduced to this, to better understand, what we are giving to the economy, if you want to talk in financial terms, but to the kind of health and growth and well-being of a nation, really.
Absolutely. It sounds fascinating. So that'll be later this summer.
Yeah.
So what's the next piece of music you've got for us?
Well, I'm still sticking into my art school days, and it comes back to David Byrne and Talking Heads. And I think one of my all-time favorites, and the video that goes along with this, Road to Nowhere, it sums up what postmodernism is all about, what consumer culture is all about, and that kind of, never-ending life cycle that we all go through. Mm. So, yeah, David Byrne has to be it.
Can you remember when you first heard it?
Oh, I do indeed.
Yeah.
I was just absolutely blown away by it.
Mm.
And then when I saw the video that went along with it, it just summed it up. Here's art school and music coming together, talking about a theoretical subject, really, in terms of postmodernist thinking.
Aspect of your life that we haven't touched upon is your feminism and the sort of work you've done to progress that. Can you tell me what your sort of broad view of feminism is as a concept, and then how you enact it on a day-to-day life or see other people doing so?
I would definitely call myself a feminist, but I also call myself a humanist. Mm. And there are lots of debates going on within architecture and design at the moment. Where are the women in these professions?
Mm.
And a lot of Twitter activity around this.
Yes.
And it's something I've been very interested in. And what I did early on with two other friends of mine is we started the Women's Design Research Unit. Right after we went to a conference, typographic conference, and there were about 30-some-odd men up on stage, all white with glasses and all of the same age. And I raised my hand and just asked the obvious question.
Yeah.
And what was really great about it, the organizers came back and asked if we wanted to be involved in a publication looking at propaganda. And so, of course, gender being highly politicized, and this was in the mid-90s.
Mm.
So it was kind of a way of bringing a group of women together to actually look at these issues, but specifically in the relationship to design. Because I realize, as a designer, I can't impact everything in the world, but I can impact, hopefully, a small corner of that world.
Yes.
And so that ripple effect, you know, perhaps would be able to make a difference in some way. Particularly young women who were looking for role models, who were looking for ways into the profession, which had been a fairly male-dominated profession at that point in time. Mm. It is slowly changing. There's still issues, but still slowly changing. So I think from that standpoint, you know, feminism has always been a perspective. But I would not call myself a radical, bra-burning feminist by any stretch of the imagination. And I think this is where being a designer kind of kicks in, where you look at an issue and a challenge, and you say, how are we going to resolve this? So it's doing workshops, it's giving talks to students, it's giving them a space, a forum, in which they can talk to each other as well, whether it's in a professional organization or whether it's with, you know, a small local community. And there's different ways of doing that through design as well.
So. And of course, you know, your other fanzines, you know, feminism and fanzines have gone hand in hand, I suspect, you know, largely because it's a forum in which opinions can be expressed freely and without, and to be frank, a lot of time just with one side of the debate put across, which is perfectly valid in that form. And I think it's fascinating, it's shaped a lot of my views about feminism, and but do you think that fanzines are a force for good in progressing that debate?
Yeah, absolutely, and it not only progressed the debate, but it progressed the cohesion of a community, because it was very, and still is very much, you know, women talking to other women and sharing their stories. Anything from you know, questions around sexuality and gender bias to what is your favorite band and how do I play a guitar?
Yes.
You know, it's all there. And I think it's really important as a vehicle itself, as a platform for that discourse to take place and for people to feel like they belong somewhere.
Yes.
They're sharing those experiences and everybody's learning from everybody else. And of course, collectively, then you get a movement. And as we know in the 90s with, you know, Riot Girl being very much that movement with a manifesto, with meetings taking place, with young girls picking up guitars and just like punk did, being able to, you know, one, two, three, and you've got your music. So I think that kind of energy, again, that, that punk originally had, but, you know, in terms of celebrating, you know, the female, the woman in the music business and everything that goes around that.
Yes.
It's just an amazing point in history, I think.
Absolutely, so what's the next piece of music?
Well, fitting in with that, of course, it has to be Kathleen Hanna, Bikini Kill, and Rebel Girl from 1993.
Oh, I'm going to enjoy turning up this tonight.
Rebel girl, I think I wanna take you home. I wanna try on your clothes.
was Bikini Girl? And you were just saying there, Till, you met Kathleen Hanna.
Yeah, I had an opportunity. Kathleen Hanna was giving a... she was on a panel discussion in New York. I think it was the College Art Association, talking about her experiences. And I thought, I'm just going to, you know, swallow my pride, go straight up to her and say, hello, Kathleen.
Yes.
She's absolutely amazing. I think what she's done for Riot Girl, but feminism more broadly, has been fantastic. And, you know, we need more, I was going to say young women like her. We've all aged, but she's aged beautifully. And she's still out there doing it with her music, very much so.
Absolutely. So give us an insight into your life. What do you do when you're not here at the Royal College of Art? You've clearly got a diverse number of interests. What do you find yourselves doing at the weekend?
What I do on the weekend, it's usually catching up from the week, like I think most academics and educators are doing at this point. I think my interest, again, you know, vary. I love going to art galleries and just seeing what's going on. I love reading a book when I have a chance. Most of my time lately has been spent writing.
Yes.
It's a space where I can get down with my own practice as a writer and think through some ideas and get excited about ideas and do some historical research, go sit in an archive, see what other people have done.
Yes.
So I think that's...
And you still like to do that? You go to the library, you know, you feel like... Even in the internet age where you probably get
I think sitting in an archive is the most amazing experience. And we're finding here that a lot of our students are intrigued by archives. And so it's kind of, again, going back to the physical object and seeing what that might reveal in terms of their own learning.
Yeah.
So, no, I'd rather go to a library and sit there and dig through old dusty boxes. It's like playing detective.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really great fun. So
tell us what you're listening to while you're doing that.
What I'm listening to while I'm doing that. Well, I think the next song I have is probably one that's slightly different than the others, and that's Kylie Minogue. Again, I am really interested in how women in the music industry can transform themselves continuously and stay on the charts.
Yes.
And so Madonna, Kylie... Yeah, Lady Gaga, they're all women, I think, that are doing amazing work. So I think the song that I tend to have on my headphones is Can't Get You Out of My Head, 2001, and just that beat of, you know, it's the syncopation on it, the kind of the drive of it, it keeps you motivated. It's good workout material, both intellectually and also in the gym.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll be doing dance now, I'm sure. So, Till, we've cast you into the desert to listen to these 8 records. How do you think you'd cope if you were out there in the desert, just your records, or we were going to come onto your luxury item? Are you the kind of person who enjoys their own company? Would you be going stir crazy after the third day?
After the third day, I'd probably just sigh a breath of relief. I like people around me. I like engaging with people. I mean, you have to, you know, in education. You've got to like your students. But I think I would really welcome that opportunity just to be able to reflect on things. And I think the list of songs that we've talked about today, there's something for almost every mood that you might encounter on your in the desert.
Yes.
That, you know, you've got a little bit of blues going on, you've got some high energy stuff to keep you motivated during the day, you got your chill out music, and as we were talking about earlier, the notion of the visual memories of some of these pop videos, like Kylie Minogue's video, Madonna, what have you, in relationship to the music. So at least you're kind of active in your head.
And I suppose, you know, if your brain was engaged and, you know, you're thinking about, you're reflecting on things, is there a period in your life that really sticks out as either quite formative or quite a different or difficult period that you feel that you had to traverse?
Well, every day's a challenge, isn't it? Making it through London
is my
constant challenge. I think... For me, the kind of formative bit was really when I got on a plane and left Texas and arrived in London as you know, a young student.
What did you have with you? What was in your suitcase?
What was in my suitcase? Well, I had a mad dash that day because I had had sold a series of photographs to a big corporation, and it was like my last little bit of money before I left and became, you know, a derelict student. So I had my razor blade in there, which you can't have on planes now. I had, you know, matting board and, you know, cut up photographs that came over with me. So and I still have all that stuff in a box in the archive.
Great stuff. And where did you live when you...
I first lived in a basement flat in West Hampstead because a friend of ours owned the house, and he said, you can have the basement, and was there for quite some time.
You're not going to move out of that.
Really good digs for the period. And then I had an opportunity to move to South London and you know, become grown up and buy a house and do all the things that you're supposed to do. But I had a really hard time leaving North London, like I think all Londoners tend to do. It was the North-South divide. I think I've acclimated a bit. I'm a good South Londoner now.
So what's your final choice today?
My final choice is from Adele. And maybe slightly obvious, but I think her song Rolling in the Deep, which, of course, was a big hit for her. But I think what I like about Adele, again, she's her own woman. She's made it in the business. And her voice is just spectacular. And it goes back to that bluesy, sultry kind of Texas sing-songy, lovely, you know, summer evenings. And, you know, I think she's great when you want to wind down and just kind of get back in touch with things.
There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch, and it's bringing me out the dark. Finally, I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out, and I'll lay your ship bare. See, I'll leave with every piece of you. Don't underestimate the things that I will do. There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch, and it's bringing
We've come to the end of your songs. Thanks so much for your time. Absolutely loved, you know, hearing about your life and your perceptions on, you know, all manner of different subjects. So if there was one fanzine that you could take with you, and then I'll give you a luxury item as well, because, you know, I think you've earned a special luxury today. What fanzine would you take with you?
What fanzine would I take? I think it would have to be the first issue of Sniffing Glue.
Really? Yeah.
Thank you, Mark Perry. Just because it was my first real introduction to the British zine culture, but also that I still feel it's one of those things that you can keep going back to and always finding something different as you flip through its A4 pages. So, yeah, it would give me good reading material.
Absolutely, yeah. Although you probably make yourself very rich on eBay these days.
Yeah. But, you can't sell these things.
No, you really can't. I would not advise that. And anything else that you would you couldn't live without in the cafe?
I think, so are we on to my luxury item yet?
Okay, great.
I think what I would really love is a pen that doesn't run out of ink. That would be my luxury item, because I think to be able to record and document not only my thoughts, but what I see around me would be amazing. So hopefully in my archive one day, some PhD student can come in, open up the box and see what I was thinking and seeing at that particular moment in history.
So that's fantastic. We'll give you a pen that never runs out of ink and even some paper too. Very kind.
Thank you.
Thank you for being my guest on Desert Isolation Discs.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks for the memories.